Welcome to the Recovery Lab podcast. We're glad you were able to join us. Recovery Lab hopes to destigmatize addiction and normalize recovery.
Our platform provides an avenue to share the many stories of those that have recovered from addiction, providing for the listener the most basic antidote to addiction.
Hope. All right, everybody, we're back. This is episode 77.
That's right. That's right.
The Recovery Lab podcast series. I'm Drew Hassan.
I'm Daniel Anderson.
We are the Recovery Lab. Oop. It still worked.
Yes, we are the Recovery Lab.
Paying homage to Freakonomics and their awesome intro music.
Absolutely. What are we doing here today?
So you and I are going to have an episode talking about how we dealt with, approached, thought about, got over, contemplated. Would you call it the grief over losing our thing that worked, the drug?
Yeah, I would say it could absolutely be characterized as grief. I mean, if we think about it, if we do a good, honest look at what drugs and alcohol did for us, they were a solution for a long time for me. I'll speak for myself only. Drugs and alcohol were a solution for me for quite a long time. They were a solution when I felt scared. They were a solution when I felt abandoned. If I didn't feel safe, if I had a good day, they were there to help me celebrate. They fit into that category of solution for years and years and years. And then suddenly they stopped working and they started working against me. And I was left with this monkey on my back that I had to address. And so removing one's best friend from their life, it's absolutely going to cause grief.
Yeah, the only coping mechanism we had. Sure.
Absolutely. So I was thinking about this day before yesterday, I guess. We had my Preston group meeting in Dallas that I hop on every day, or try to do every day. We were talking about, relinquishing the thought that drugs and alcohol were going to be a solution for us in our lives. And I started thinking about this, and it started making a lot. It was something that I really felt led to talk about on the Recovery Lab, because it was something that I struggled with for years and years and years. And I saw it as a bit of an onion, if you will. So the first layer of my addiction was alcohol. Alcohol was not my drug of choice. Every time I relapsed, alcohol was involved, but it was not my drug of choice. I've been drunk maybe 5 times, 6 times in my life. It didn't fit that box for me. But again, every time that I relapsed, alcohol was involved. So at the beginning of my journey into sobriety, the thought was there that, okay, alcohol is never going to be a solution for me. That's easy. I got that. That's not a problem. I can take alcohol or leave it. It's not a problem. So, but stimulant medications such as Adderall, Vyvanse, anything like that, those may still be a solution for me. And also marijuana, absolutely my best friend that's been there since I was 12 years old. That's still a solution for me. So I go on with that mindset for a number of years, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And then I am a tornado throughout that whole entire time. I'm hitting my head against the wall, blooding my face up by, bashing my head against walls over and over and over again. And then I finally get to a realization, hey, you know what? And meth was in that category as well with the stimulants. Finally, a number of years later, I get to a point where, hey, you know what? Methamphetamine, stimulant medications, and alcohol, definitely not going to be a solution for me ever, ever again in my life. I've proved that to myself. It's never going to work for me. You know, for those that can drink and use successfully, more power to you. I have no ill will towards you, no resentment towards you for you being able to do something successfully that I can't. I know that I can't do stimulant medications or Adderall or alcohol in any way, shape, or form. But maybe marijuana can still be a solution for me. It's a plant, for God's sake, right? It's God grows it out of the ground.
The Lord gave it to us.
So why could that not be a solution for me? If I'm having a hard day, maybe toke a little bit, you know, get a vape pen and maybe just one hit every once in a while, maybe just to get to sleep, you know. I work hard all day, and when it comes time to unwind at night, I struggle with that. That's just my body, and marijuana really, really helps me to kind of just relax a little bit, take a step back from the world. So that's going to be a solution for me. It has to. So that goes on for another 8, 9, 10, 12 years of little pot here, a little pot there. And by a little pot, I mean it starts slowly, and then it's every day, and then it's morning, noon, and night, and then it's all day, every day. And then I would stop for a little bit and get going again, and it'd be right back to where I was before. So I'm just hard-headed. I'm just tremendously hard-headed, Drew. So I would hit my head against the wall. This went on for 10 years of, you know, nothing else other than just pot, right? I can do pot like a gentleman. That's not a problem. It's a plant after all. Again, the same results, hitting my head against the wall, causing harms in my life, in those lives that are around me, and anyone that comes in contact with me, over and over and over again, trying every angle, trying every, lower the amount that I'm taking in, higher the amount, raise the amount that I'm taking in. Try it, you know, only smoking with my left hand and then only smoking with my right hand and using a Bic lighter instead of a more expensive lighter like a Zippo and just like all of these things. And then finally, I hit my head against the wall enough times. And granted, we're like 17, 18 years into bouncing in and out of AA. It's tragic, honestly, but it takes what it takes. But so finally, April 10th of 2021, the day before I got sober this time, I found myself at a point where I was faced with the reality that I have exhausted every imaginable way to smoke like a gentleman. Every imaginable way. And there are absolutely people who can smoke like gentlemen and gentleladies. It doesn't cause problems in their lives. It's a positive thing for them in their lives. And it doesn't cause problems. And I had to get to a point where I had done enough research for me in my life. There's not any amount of words that anybody that had gone before me could have told me for me to be like, oh, you know what? You're right. Maybe I should just not smoke weed. You know what? You're absolutely right. That's what I'm going to do, and my life is going to... No, I would not have listened to anyone. I had to have that personal research and development on this particular thing. And finally, I was blessed with the thought one night that, damn it, this is never going to be a solution for me. I've got to learn how to use the tools of the program in order to live life on life's terms. There is never going to be a point in my life where I am able to use some sort of substance to help me deal with what I'm dealing with in life. And it wasn't until I made that decision that, okay, this is ground zero. I've got to do the hard shit that's required in order to become at peace with every part of me and to learn to be okay with the insecure parts, the scared parts, the nervous parts, the exciting parts, the fun parts. I've got to do something else other than having that crutch to be able to say, hey, you know what? I can lean on this. I can lean on this when times are hard. I can lean on this when times are hard. And it was an exciting realization and moment, but it was equally, if not more terrifying, because I knew that hard work was about to have to take place. And in order for me to really, really move past this grief that we were talking about, I was going to have to talk to people. I was going to have to go to probably a lot of meetings. I was going to have to call my sponsor on a regular basis and be open and vulnerable with him and honest with him. I was going to probably have, therapy was going to play a part in my life. There were a lot of things that I was running from in active addiction, that, you know, issues with, you know, number one probably being, you know, abandonment issues, fears of, you know, not being loved, not being appreciated, not appreciated, but not being loved, not being liked. I mean, that's still something that I struggle with every day. It's not as hard as it was before, but it's something that will be with me until the day I die. And I don't feel as though I'm alone in that. And I certainly don't have shame as a result of being open and honest about the fact that, yeah, I can be an insecure child very easily. I can get to that point ridiculously quickly. I can be a scared guy. I can be financially insecure. I can be fearful about every little thing that's going on in my life. And fortunately, I have a higher power who I choose to call God today that really helps when I ask him for help, really, really, really helps me to become at peace with those thoughts and those feelings. And then ultimately, number one, I've got a fairly robust set of tools in my tool belt that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have so freely given me just as a result of me sitting down and listening and taking on what they have to offer. So I've got tools today. I've got things that I can do in order to deal with everything that can come my way. There is not anything that I will go through or have gone through that someone else in recovery has not gone through, walked through with dignity and grace, and now are on the other side of that, and they're now able to use those experiences as a net positive to help someone else. There's not anything that could happen to me that hasn't happened to someone else before. So yes, it is a process. It is a grief. It can be a scary, sad, dark place. But for me, that grief and that fear, after about the first week of no substances, the feelings that I got as a result of doing the right thing slowly started to outweigh the sadness that was associated with losing my best friend.
There was a lot.
All right, that's the show. We'll see you guys next week. All right, so what was it like for you, Drew? What was, let me switch this over here. What was that process? I know this isn't a speaker meeting, but I kind of made it that way. What was the process like for you? How long did it take? Did you struggle with coming to that realization? What was that process like for you in your life?
That I wasn't going to be able to
drink and use like a gentleman.
I think that I am the most grateful, and it took a minute to get to feel this, but not as long as you might think. I'm grateful that I was physically addicted to something. I am grateful that I had the monkey on my back, where to such an extent that I had to use all day, every day. You know, there became a time where I wasn't using to celebrate. I wasn't using to mask some other feeling. I was using because I had to all day long. From the time I woke up.
Otherwise, you would get sick. There were physical consequences if you didn't.
Yeah, and then there were mental consequences of being clear-headed. The worst time is when, like, you pass out for a while and you wake up and you're not really under the influence anymore, and the world and the consequences is at the fore, and, you know, and all you can think of is I need, you know, with the quickness, I need to find something. So the idea that I was going to be able to use in some way that was, I guess, socially acceptable, you know, I knew there was no such thing as socially acceptable heroin use, socially acceptable meth use. So I wasn't bummed about that because I knew that that wasn't really a thing.
See, my alcoholic and addict mind was telling me that there are people that do meth and heroin socially and are successful at it.
Right. They're not. I mean,
I knew that.
There was never going to be a way that I was going to be hanging out at my parents' house and be like, you know, I'll be back in a few minutes.
I gotta load my rig real quick. I'll be back in five minutes.
In the bathroom.
Right. Do you have a rubber band, like a thick rubber band that I could borrow real quick? Right.
You know, I guess the thing that struck me the most when you were sharing is, and I've been thinking about this since Friday. Friday, I went to a continuing legal education that was about addiction and recovery. And Denise Marster spoke. Oh. And she was given her talk. It was fantastic. She's a great presenter. And because this was geared towards an audience of people who didn't all have addiction problems with a substance, I think some had gambling problems, some had, I guess, sex addiction or relationship problems, some had just mental health problems unrelated to addiction, eating disorders, that kind of thing. So she was really giving a much more broad topic, much more broad speech than just on the sole topic of polysubstance abuse. And she said, listen, if you think that you can stop doing whatever it is that is your thing to do, and that's that, then you're not valuing the strength of addiction as a whole properly. And her words were, look, when you quit doing what you like doing, your addiction's doing a Google search to find a replacement for it. And that is the God's honest truth. I know that I could go to the liquor store today, if they were open in Mississippi on Sundays, but I could go get a bottle of Pinot Noir and I could have a couple glasses this afternoon, and it would probably not impact my life to any significant extent. Truly, that could absolutely happen this afternoon. Why don't then I go get Pinot Noir and have some Monday afternoon when I get off work, knowing that it probably would not cause much of a problem in my life, not even a little bit. And that's because I fully recognize that cross addiction is a real thing. And I recognize that by engaging in certain behaviors, I make it a little more likely that I'm going to do what I do like doing, and that's shooting up meth, Dilaudid, and heroin. Because I like doing those things. And I know that if I drink a little bit, I've read this book before. You know, I'm just going to smoke weed. And you can do that for a little while, and it'll work. But you've cracked open Pandora's box a little bit. And whatever's in Pandora's box is going to come out. It might not come out for a week. It might not come out for a month. But you've made it easier to happen. So there are things that I don't do, even though I could probably get away with it. I could probably drink a beer or two and stop at a beer or two for some duration of time. I could probably have a glass of wine or two at night for some period of time, but I'm eventually going to drink like an addict drinks. And it's just a matter of time. And those things aren't worth it to me. So another thing that I thought was interesting about what Denise brought up and how I've experienced my own life. When we start making these deals with ourselves about how I'm going to moderate my usage of some mood altering substance, and I guess that you could really replace eating, addiction, relationship addiction, acting out sexually. You know, you could replace, I think they're called process addiction. I think you could replace those things. They would fit into this scheme pretty well. Whenever I'm making these deals, these bargains with myself to make it easier to justify engaging in either the kind of destructive behaviors like eating, sex, gambling, that kind of thing, or using a little bit of something that I deem is not so problematic, then what we're really doing that really should be viewed as a barometer for how well we're doing in our recovery. Because if you need to be brokering these deals with yourselves, it ought to be setting off some alarm bell that I'm not really doing in my recovery that which should be done to address my underlying character defects. What I'm really doing is signaling that I've got these things that I'm not taking care of by working the steps, and I need to figure out a way to get to enter into those kinds of reality deterrence behaviors that drinking and using is for us. In Denise's lecture, speech, talk, whatever you want to call it, really kind of opened my mind to some things. Like if I'm not doing the things that I need to be doing, then that will manifest itself in the, you know, you're kicking the dog and you're yelling at your kids and you're being a dick to your wife and I can see how I should not look at those things when I do them, when I, you know, kick the cat and yell at my kids and dick to my wife. I shouldn't look at it and think, oh gosh, I'm a bad person because I can't control myself. I should really take, you know, a more 30,000 foot view and think, what am I not really addressing in my own recovery that's making these things manifest themselves? And so when I think I'm going to go get a glass of wine tonight because I know realistically it's not going to cause any problems, then that should really trigger alarm bells that there's something left untreated in my addiction, that there's something something is going unresolved, something is going unaddressed that I really need to take a look at. And I don't know when in my recovery I began to think things like that, but I'm grateful I do, because how long? I mean, I can remember going to St. Philip's and taking, you know, Valium towards the end of the meeting so that it would be kicking in, you know, right when the meeting was over and I was on my way home. Like, that's crazy. Because I had a prescription for it. Because I was able to hoodwink some doctor into giving me a prescription for Valium. I mean, the things that we come up with so that we don't feel like we're screwing up, it's amazing, the lengths that we take.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm going to go to this meeting, but I'm going to get gooned up on benzos. I mean, it's... So, you know, I'm able now to know that I was not handling things that I needed to handle. And because I was not taking care of my business, my addiction, did a Google search, it found something that would suitably replace it, and you know, developed a fondness for Valium.
Right.
Got off Valium, found something else to replace it. So to the listener, if you're newly in recovery and you just sobered up off of whatever it is that you dig doing, if you don't engage in a pretty robust system of recovery, your addiction's going to find something else to replace it. Either a whole pint of Haagen-Dazs every night and you gain 40 pounds, which, I mean, truth be told, maybe
there are worse things.
There are worse things that you could do than gain 40 pounds in early recovery. But you'll replace it with, you know, exercise addiction, workaholism. Those were a couple of things that she had on her list. You know, exercise bulimia is a real thing. Like, oh, I've got to go, you know, I ate that candy bar, so I need to go jog to burn that candy bar off. You can tell I don't have that. I don't have that problem.
I also do not have that problem. But yeah, it's, you know, I think I wish that speech or that talk was online somewhere. That would be lovely. She's a fantastic woman and brilliant to boot. So how many, when did you, was there a moment that you can remember that, that you had the thought like, uh-oh, this is a problem? Or did you know from the beginning that what you were doing with your using and drinking was not normal, A, and B, was going to be a problem and going to cause serious problems?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was physically addicted to something, I thought, that's what you get. That's what you get. You grab the tiger by the tail, and now, Mr. Clever, you can't. You've got to pay the piper. So one of the things that I'm that kept me sick for a long time is being 2/3 clever and largely able to avoid any real consequences.
Right.
For a long time, and it kept me sick for a long time because I didn't recognize my poor behavior for what it was. What I focused on was, I'm clever enough to have avoided these consequences. And that's why I say, I think I'm grateful that I know what physical addiction feels like. And I know what it's like to lose things. And so I'm grateful for that because I'm able now more easily to buy into the idea that I can't take any mood altering substances. Period. The end. There's no bargaining. There's no halfway. I'm completely okay with, I mean, there are people that I know and love that have marijuana prescriptions, and I'm like, more power to you. I don't blame you. I like the way marijuana feels too. I don't go get a marijuana prescription, even though I have some of those same, you know, problems that they use to get their marijuana prescription. I don't go get a marijuana prescription because I abuse my privilege. And I know that if I start, I'm going to open Pandora's box. You know, those people that I know that I'm thinking about in my mind can have a marijuana prescription because, you know, they're not going to go see the dope man. You know, if they don't get their prescription filled, they don't feel some kind of way. I would be obsessed with it like I was every other time I had any drug, you know. Obsessing over, you know, how am I going to stretch this prescription to last? You know, how much can I take today? If I take a few too many tomorrow, all right, well, I guess I'll only be out Monday and Tuesday. You know, I mean, all that just, it's,
and then the
it's maddening.
Yeah. Like the internal conversation that I used to have with my, like, regarding any sort of stimulant, like with meth at the latter stages or Vyvanse or Adderall. You know, it was I had a board meeting in my head every single day. Okay. So if I'm going to open up this Vyvanse pill, I'm going to pour it all out onto a scale, and then I'm going to measure out exactly how much I can. And then I'm going to put it in my mouth and I'm going to eat it. But then I would be like, but this is a really big job. And I really need this extra energy.
I need to pay attention at work.
I really, I mean, me being able to pay my bills depends on me getting this right.
I can't afford not to take it.
And then the shame associated with that. And then at the end of the month when, damn it, I'm out of my medication before. I got to go get another bag of meth.
I'm going to have to get some meth.
I just
3 days early turns into 5 to 10.
That was,
and then it's 2 weeks early, and now you're thinking, well, I could just forge a prescription.
I could.
I mean,
it would only be one time. because next month I'm not going to make this mistake again.
They're not going to think I would do that.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I'm Daniel Anderson.
Yeah. I see them all the time. They like me.
Yeah, it's not a big deal.
It's not a big deal.
Yeah. It's crazy how we, you know, we can justify things and it just turns into shit.
To shit.
There's just no two ways around it.
Well, you asked me when did I know that?
Yeah, was there a marker in your life where you're like, uh-oh, okay, this is what I know I need to do, but I'm not ready to do this, or I can't do this yet, or something along those lines?
You know, I guess the first time that I felt, you know, what we call being dope sick, from opiate withdrawal, and I thought I was coming down with the flu, or you know something like that, and I was really like, "Damn, I didn't necessarily bargain for this problem." And then you talk about obsession. I mean, all you want to do is feel better, and so like. I did not get to stay at the entire day of that conference that I was talking about on Friday. And Keenan Wald from Columbus, Mississippi, who I love, was the last speaker. And I did not get to hear him, but he gave a speech about maybe the limbic system. I'm not exactly sure. But I know he's pretty keen on talking about how addiction affects the mind and kind of the physical inner workings of dopamine, serotonin, and those kinds of things. And I'm sure it would have been really interesting to listen to. The idea that if I don't go get this drug, I'm going to feel bad, you know, kind of soured quickly the fun part of drug use.
Right.
Keenan is, you know, he says, look, we all start with pleasure seeking and we all end with pain avoidance.
Right.
And thank God, you know, being physically addicted to something, you know, and while meth isn't physically addicting, it's psychologically addicting. There's no question in my mind.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's no question in my mind that there's withdrawal from meth because you feel like you're crazy.
Yeah.
If you don't do it, and then hell, you feel like you are crazy when you're on it. But
and if you don't do it, all you want to do is sleep. And like, how am I ever going to get past this? Like,
yeah.
I can't do anything. I don't feel motivated to do anything. Yeah,
it's just too, it's too hard.
Right.
So, I guess by the time that I got to treatment, I so wanted off of substances that, and I felt so much better physically in pretty short order. It was good. I don't remember who we were talking about the other day. You know, when you quit shooting up, you immediately have fewer life problems.
Right.
Now, you know, fortunately I was sobered up and I was able to stop shooting up while I had a roof over my head and food to eat. You know, if I hadn't been at that place, I wouldn't have had either of those things. So, you know, that was like where I'm going to sleep tonight was a legitimate problem.
Yeah.
I don't have any money for a hotel. I'm certainly not going back to my family's, you know, my family doesn't want me there. So, you know, you've got like these caveman like desires, you know, you've got real sustenance issues. There's no food to be had. You don't really want any, but you don't have any money to eat anything. And, you know, I don't have somewhere to sleep. And being able to solve those problems, you know, enabled me to focus on just not getting high and the benefits from it. And there's a magic to linking the drug use with the deprivation of things that are good in life. Like, it did not take a whole lot of logic for me to realize that it was directly the fact that I'm walking down Beasley Atkins at night with a backpack on would not be happening if I hadn't started doing drugs like I was doing. Like, it just wouldn't. I would still have a car. I would still have a home. These things were taken from me. I gave these things away so that I could do drugs like I wanted. And there was just no question in my mind that the things were linked and related. And to be able to stop doing drugs for a period of time enabled me to feel a whole lot better. There at the end, I was just as miserable as a human could be. You know, I'd gotten to the part where the drugs just simply were not getting the job done. And I can only imagine that I would have either gotten sober or killed myself, either purposefully or on accident.
Yeah. Well, I think we had talked about this being a little bit shorter episode today because it's a single topic. And I think that there was a lot of good stuff said today. And I just want to take... I want to take a second to talk to those that are either sober curious or at the end of their rope, or there are many, many options. If you have a desire to stop the way that you are living right now and to try to figure out a way to get that monkey off your back, there are ways. If you have money, there are ways. If you don't have money, there is a way for
you.
There
are options.
There are absolutely options. And if you have any questions whatsoever, I am 100% here to help anyone, to the point where I am more than happy to give you my cell phone number. My number is 601-672-6591. Or you can email me at daniel@audioalchemy.co. And we have crossed paths. Drew and I both have crossed paths with thousands and thousands
of
people.
We have connections.
Yeah, absolutely. In our own recovery, as well as the work that we've done with the recovery lab. And we have wonderful people like Jody Pinton. We have wonderful people like Denise. We have all sorts of people, Costas over at Bridge to Recovery. If you have a desire to get sober, we can put you in contact
money,
with someone.
No money,
money, no
maybe.
We've got Harbor House. We've got Defining Wellness. We've got places all over the state of Mississippi, and for that matter, all over the country. Brian O'Shea is right there waiting at the door.
Mr. Connected.
Absolutely willing to help anyone. With anything. So if you are struggling and you need some help, please, 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 please reach out to us. Give us a call. Shoot us an email. You can go to recoverylabllc.com. Check out our recovery resources if that's something that you would like. We are here for you. That is why we're here. We are here to give back and to help the next person that's coming up, so that person can then help the next person that's behind them. That is our goal. That is our mission. So thank you so much for tuning in today and for selecting this on your podcasting app. We will be here. Actually, next week is
Easter.
Easter. Are you going to be here?
No.
Okay. All right. We're going to take next week off, but we'll see you the following week. And thank you so much for joining us. And we'll see you in a couple weeks. All right. Take care, guys.